Good afternoon, everybody. Good moed, more din l'simcha. Shmuel Plotzker coming at you live from my house. It is Monday, October 2nd of the year 23. It's the first day of Chol HaMoed here in the Golus, and we're going to read to you from the Return to Zion, Addresses on Religious Zionism and American Orthodoxy. This was delivered in April 1954. The State of Israel has been around already for 6 years. The Soloveitchik calls this particular lecture, Zionism and the Mizrahi from the perspective of a raven head and a dove head. He'll explain that he has both heads. Page 155. Moravi Rabotai, Gemara Bava Kama 92b. If there is something negative to say about you, make sure to be the first to admit it. As it is written, quote, he said, I am Abraham's servant. Pasuk in Genesis 24, remember Eliezer goes to do the shidduch for Rivka. He introduces himself as Eved Avraham Anochi. I am the servant of Abraham. If you have a deficiency, bring it up before others do. A rather practical piece of advice, and one I plan to follow tonight. By the way, that also, yeah, I can't have more. That is also good advice in a trial. Don't be the second one to make mention of your case's weakness, because if you do, it looks as if you're hiding something, and it's the last thing you want. You don't want to be perceived by the judge or the jury as hiding anything. You want to come out with it, because when you come out with it, you're perceived as the honest one, and you didn't hide anything. I will reveal to you a major deficiency of mine. I am a diencephalic firstborn, see Menachos 37a. A person with two heads. But I wish to make a prefatory observation. Despite the fact that I am a diencephalic firstborn, it seems to me that my father of blessed memory, even if he weren't a Levi, would not have been obligated to redeem me twice using 10 shekels, because, as I can tell you from personal experience, when hot water is poured on one head, the other one cries out as well. For such a firstborn, as you all presumably know, 5 shekels suffice. In other words, I am a firstborn with two heads, but not two souls, two personas. And so I must introduce my two heads. The first is the head of a dove. You all surely know that in the Bible and the Midrash, a dove symbolizes innocence. My faultless dove, it says in Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, chapter 5, verse 2, and purity of spirit. A dove symbolizes innocence and purity of spirit. It is the purest of all pure bird species. For this reason, the dove was allowed to be brought upon the Mizbeach as a sacrifice. Pasuk says, if his offering to God is a burnt offering of birds, he shall choose his offering from turtle doves or pigeons. See Leviticus 1. It also symbolizes faithfulness to its owner. The dove followed Noah. And when Noah was despondent, the dove came toward evening during his twilight-like sadness, and there in its bill was a plucked-off olive leaf, Genesis 8, a tiding of consolation and encouragement. The dove does not haggle. It does not argue. It trusts its friends. It cannot offend. All it can do is drone over its pain. Like the Pasuk says in Ezekiel 7, like doves of the valley moaning together. The dove is a beloved bird. This dove head is a true Mizrahi member. It may be the case that I have not paid membership dues for a couple of years already, but you can believe this dove. It is a member of the Mizrahi. Always has been and continues to be today. Faultless. You can knock on its door even in the middle of the night and whisper quietly, let me in, my own, my darling, my faultless dove. The second head is, God preserve you, that of a raven, an impure bird and black as the night on top of it. The raven is, as you all know well, far from innocent. It is by nature suspicious. It is also stubborn and mischievous. It is constantly asking questions, not obeying its owner or benefactor. It says about Noah, he sent out the raven. It went to and fro. An oppositionist. A contrarian, always at odds with the world order, with everything and with everyone. In short, a revolutionary, a radical, and a zealot. What the Raven is in partisan terms, I do not know. It is very difficult for me to properly formulate its political affiliation. One fears to get involved with the Raven, as it can stand up and deliver an official rebuke from its perch, making one look like a liar. And yet, I will permit myself to note that despite the fact that the Raven is stubborn, focused on others' shortcomings and defects, and individualistic, the type who consistently responds to Achad Ha'am's question, "Is it possible that the whole world is wrong and the Jews are right?" by answering, "It is entirely possible." Sichatzi Nechama in Hamelitz, published in 1892. Despite all of that, this Raven was not present at the demonstration held in front of the Israeli consulate in New York on February 8, 1954, protesting the conscription of women for national service. Not, heaven forbid, because it is any less of a zealot than the Jews who danced in the streets and sang, "Utsu Eitza Visufar, Dabru Dabra Velo Yakum, Ki Imono Kel. Hatch a plot, it shall be foiled," says in Isaiah chapter 8. Not because of that, but rather because it is cool-headed and very slow to hysteria. I imagine he's talking about himself. This Raven was not present at that demonstration. Top 157. Rabotai, I inherited both of these heads from the Knesset Yisrael. On the one hand, Judaism connotes faithfulness. I'm sorry. Judaism connotes faultlessness, self-sacrifice, and unity with the Jewish people. It is the embodiment of the worship of the heart, of the feelings of enthusiasm and ardor, of love and loving kindness. But on the other hand, Judaism preaches stubbornness, resoluteness, a critical attitude, clear and free thought and behavior, and avoiding misleading oneself with opaque sentiments and unfathomable emotions. In short, the Raven's character. If there is one field in which human critical inquiry has almost absolute liberty, it is the field of the halacha. You all know Rabbi Yeshua ben Hanania's response to the heavenly voice, "Lo b'shamayim hi," it is not in the heavens. See Deuteronomy 30, see Baba Metzia 59b. From my youth onward, I was taught to think critically and freely, not to repeat cliched phrases or be satisfied with vacuous terminology. When you learn through a comment by the Tosfos, my father of blessed memory would say, think it over. Make an effort to understand it. If something seems difficult to you or you are bothered by a question, try not to give an incorrect answer. My father would tell me that one time my grandfather, the great Reb Chaim Brisker of blessed memory, said, "Moshe, do you know what my analytical methodology consists of? I do not allow myself to be misled." Not just by, and here he mentioned the name of a contemporary of his, a Torah giant from the previous generation, but even by Rabbeinu Tam and Rambam. When Rambam says something, I do not blindly accept it. I want to know what the source is, how you understand it. And I also want to know if that understanding holds up logically. In pure halacha, Rabotai, one must be a radical rationalist. If not, one cannot be a Talmudist. And so you understand very well that it is under these circumstances that I developed a raven head. The raven is truly an impure bird species, a universally hated creature, not a beloved one. Still, Judaism included the raven in its eternal history. He sent out the raven. It went to and fro until the waters had dried up from the earth. Rashi comments, the raven was ready for a different mission at the time of the drought in the days of Eliyahu. As it says, the ravens brought him bread and meat. See 1 Kings 17. Noah had wanted to eliminate the black raven, which had showed the residents of the ark such stubbornness, ruthlessness, and cruelty. Noah had thought, what purpose does it serve to have such an ugly black bird in the beautiful post-diluvian world? The dove will represent the new world order. The Almighty God said to him, leave the raven be. Do it no harm. And do not denigrate it overmuch. The raven was ready for a different mission at the time of the drought in the days of Eliyahu. The dove will not always succeed in faithfully carrying out all of its missions. A time will come when the ruler will be Achav, all the prophets will worship the Baal, and the quiet bird, the dove, will be unable to fight such a force. Then it will be necessary to have access to the raven. Its chutzpah, its revolutionary spirit, its radicalism, its extremism, Noach, the raven, has a purpose in this world. It is ready for a different mission. It seems to me that along with my best wishes and sincerest intentions to appreciate the contributions of the diplomatic dove to the birth of the state of Israel, I must state openly that without the raven, the conspirator, the revolutionary, the underground fighter, there would still be no state of Israel today. Reading about the most recent developments in the land of Israel, it appears to me that the raven's task there is not yet complete. It is ready for a different mission. As I stressed earlier, I have two heads, but one soul. These two heads, the dove head and the raven head, are only manifest outwardly in my public facing persona. Inwardly, in the space known as Mistarim, where a Jew hears the solemn cry of the Shechina, Sichagiga 5b, unity and harmony reign. In that space, there is no contradiction between the dove, full of love and affection, and the raven, the strict critic and rationalist. Therein is fulfilled the verse, he imposes peace in his heights. Osef Shalom Bimromav. See Job 25. The master of the universe makes peace between Michael, the ministering angel of water, of cool, clear, critical thinking, and Gabriel, the ministering angel of fire, of burning love, the same love that is fierce as death and mighty as Sheol, whose sparks are darts of fire, a blazing flame. See Song of Songs 8. See Sefer HaTanya. See Igeret HaKodesh. And see Shir HaShirim Rabbah. Let us proceed further. Since at least outwardly I still have two heads, that of a dove and that of a raven, and I do not wish to insult either one, I must call both up for Aliyah tonight. Both the dove and the raven must ascend to read from the Torah. I had serious questions about the proper order. Jews squabble with one another about receiving the third and sixth Aliyot, and I do not want my two heads to start to quarrel at a conference called to bring unity and peace to the Jewish people. Therefore, after much debate and hesitation, I decided to give the raven the Kohen's Aliyah and the dove Maftir. You all know well that the Hebrew word for dove, Yonah, is a feminine noun. So the dove cannot be called up as one of the seven main aliyot. But the rabbis say in Megillah 23a, a woman should not read from the Torah out of respect for the congregation. This is especially true today when there is so much fighting about national service and the conscription of women, and the Aguda holds the line on the purity of the Jewish home. But besides this reason, the raven earned the Kohen's Aliyah this evening on its own merits. First, the fact that I came to the conference today after having not attended a Mizrahi convention for so many years is thanks to the raven. As long as the doves, whether from the Union of Orthodox Rabbis or the Rabbinical Council of America, would fly to a Mizrahi meeting like doves to their coats, see Isaiah 60, the raven would prevent me from participating. He would tell me, they will do without you. When Job was rich, the verse reports, all his brothers and sisters and all his former friends came to him and had a meal with him. See Job 42. Even members of the Presidium of the Union of Orthodox Rabbis. But when Job became, God preserve you, impoverished, mired in pain, they got scared, those doves. Only three ravens arrived, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Sophar. I am one of them. Second, the raven comes to carry out a task of which the dove is incapable. Hakarat hachet, recognition of the sin. The idea of tshuva, including hakarat hachet, is perhaps the greatest principle in all of Judaism, the highest ethical norm bequeathed by the Knesset Yisrael to the world at large, of which, one of which, proud chutzpahdik modern man has no understanding. Judaism teaches man that in times of crisis, one ought not search for scapegoats or accuse others, usually the weak and helpless who cannot defend themselves, but rather blame oneself. Judaism demands of man a heroic act, the boldness of hakarat achet, recognition of sin, the bravery to break one's will, to solemnly declare, as the prophet Jonah once did, "This terrible storm came upon you on my account." Judaism believes that the master of the universe tests man specifically via the trial of hakarat achet, of swallowing his false pride and saying, "I have sinned." I believe that my friends in the Mizrahi and Apollo Mizrahi will forgive me if the raven begins investigating our immediate past a bit, introspecting, and perhaps arriving at some uncomfortable conclusions. I want to assure you that the raven is judging himself. Here I must note, as my grandfather Reb Chaim would on Shabbos Shuvah before his sermon in the Kalta Shul of Brisk, the truth is that I am not speaking to anyone else, just to me, myself. Chaim is speaking to Chaim. However, a person obviously cannot speak to himself. It goes against common sense. Therefore, I must appear to be rebuking you. If we have sinned, then I am just as culpable as anyone else, and we will all strike our chests while reciting the Al-Khayt litany. Hakarat Achet is no disgrace. On the contrary, it elevates man and redeems his persona from all manner of smallness and meanness. It is not for naught that Providence bestowed the monarchy not upon Joseph, who never fell into sin, but specifically upon Judah, who did stumble on a couple of occasions. Judah descended from his brothers, for the monarchy can only be granted to one mighty enough to remain great even in the midst of his sin, to climb up from his descent. The Kutzker would explain the verse, "Judah is a lion's whelp," Yaakov says this on his deathbed, Genesis 49, as follows: Judah is a lion, not because he never stumbled, but rather because, quote, he crouches, lies down like a lion. That is, even when he declined and fell, he remained a lion. Tisfas Emes on Parshas Vayechi. If the Mizrahi and Apollo Mizrahi have inscribed on their flag not only the ideal of the state of Israel, but especially the vision of Jewish sovereignty, they must embody the principle of he crouches, he lies down like a lion. Rabbatai, we must confess, not for a specific sin we have committed, I know of no such sins, but for an inferiority complex, for, quote, the humility of Rabbi Zechariah ben Ucholus, Sigitin 56, for not recognizing our own power and strength, for having tolerated a particular spiritual climate and remarkable atmosphere in the land of Israel, a psychic idiosyncrasy that presents more signs of peril than all the claims of the Aguda taken together. Top 161. We Jews are a people suffused with a sense of gratitude, of appreciating individuals' accomplishments on behalf of the community. We mention with reverence the names of all the builders and leaders of the Knesset Yisrael from our forefather Abraham on down to the present. The Jewish people never forgets a kindness done by one of its sons. Its byword is, remember the days of old. Consider the years of ages past. Deuteronomy 32. However, showing gratitude is one thing. Deification, apotheosis, and forming a cult of personality or political party is an entirely different matter. Judaism despises gaiva, hubris, displayed by anyone, but particularly by a king, by a person who, or movement that, exerts power and influence. Thus he will not act haughtily toward his fellows. See Deuteronomy 17. The Torah warns the king of Israel. A king of Israel must possess a sense of loving kindness and mercy and realize that the monarchy for Jews is more servitude than lordship and that the people owe him nothing. On the contrary, he owes the people everything. The more power and success one has, the more modesty and humility one needs. A plain Jew bows only during the Amidah blessings of Avot and Hoda'ah, a Kohen Gadol during each blessing. And the king, once he bows the first time, he does not straighten his back for the duration. See Gemara Brachos 34a and b. When the Bible wishes to describe a king of Israel who has departed from the straight and narrow, it always begins with the stock phrase, when he was strong, he grew arrogant. See 2 Chronicles 26. Judaism manifested this attitude magnificently in the Haggadah for the first night of Pesach. One tells the story of the Exodus from Egypt in all its details, with all its signs and wonders. And the more one tells, the more praiseworthy one is. But the main hero of the story was forgotten. Our teacher Moshe is nowhere to be found. Not only do we not mention him, but we emphasize that we owe him nothing. The Almighty freed us from Egypt, Deuteronomy 26, not via an angel, not via a seraph, and not via an agent. Rather, the Blessed Holy One himself freed us. Why do we not show Moshe our gratitude? The answer is that even the greatest personality the Jewish people has ever produced can have no central significance in the drama of Jewish history, which is only two actors, the Master of the Universe and Knesset Yisrael. The apotheosis of Moses on the night of Passover would be idolatrous. Moshe is indistinguishable from the rest of the Jewish people as they leave Egypt. He is no more privileged than other Jews. Unfortunately, the modern history of the return to Zion has not adopted this philosophical ethical attitude. It is dominated by a cult of personality and idolatrous worship of man. I believe this stems to a great extent from an arrogant Marxist Weltanschauung, at the center of which stands the concept of Kochi Ba'otzim Yadi, Asalias, what's the term? One is wealth for me. It's what? The Chayal Azeh? Thank you, honey. Thank you. My own power and the might of my own hands have won this wealth for me. Pardon. Deuteronomy 8. That is a Marxist attitude. Again, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, this is important here. The modern history of the return to Zion, secular Zionism, is dominated by a cult of personality and idolatrous worship of man. I believe this stems to a great extent from an arrogant Marxist Weltanschauung, at the center of which stands the concept of my own power and the might of my own hands have won this wealth for me. Of course, Zionism was born in socialism, so it would have that attitude. Zionism is a noble idea with many weak points, and its biggest vulnerability is its glorification of man. I have the greatest respect for the Mapai movement led by the former prime minister. I envy the organization as a whole, and Ben-Gurion in particular, for the loving kindness that Providence displayed in appointing them to play such an outsized role in the building of the land and in the conquering of the state of Israel. The private lives of the builders, whether they live in accordance with the Torah or in opposition to it, do not interest me. A historical truth cannot be altered, even when the person whom Providence selected to carry out a particular mission is not to our liking. And for good reason. On the one hand, the verse in chapter 14 of 2 Kings says about Jeroboam ben Joash, he did what was displeasing to God. He did not depart from all the sins that Jeroboam ben Nevat caused Israel to commit. On the other hand, the verse solemnly declares, it was he who restored the territory of Israel from the Volchamah to the Sea of the Arabah, in accordance with the promise of the Almighty, the God of Israel. But what do you think it means? He did everything. He sinned, but he also did stuff politically that was pleasing in God's eyes. He did it in accordance with what Hashem told him, said to do. For the Almighty saw the very bitter plight of Israel, with neither bond nor free left, and with none to help Israel. And God resolved not to blot out the name of Israel from under heaven. And God delivered them through Jeroboam ben Joash. End quote. If so, I too can say of Ben-Gurion, it was he who restored the territory of Israel from Akko to Eilat. For the Almighty saw the plight of Israel, with none to help Israel, and God delivered them through David Ben-Gurion and his compatriots. Quite a thing to say for a big rabbi. Gemara in Shabbos 55a, the seal of the Almighty is truth, and our seal, too, must be truth. I am particularly impressed by the raven-like character of the Mapai and Ben-Gurion. Their energetic actions in moments of crisis, their organization of the army, especially their disbanding of the semi-autonomous Palmach and their chutzpahdik position in certain cases against the Gentile world have always summoned admiration in me. Ben-Gurion in particular has much enthusiasm and ardor, a mystical inclination, and above all, a very clear head. But both the Mapai and Ben-Gurion have a deficiency, gaiva, a propensity for self-glorification. The ability of the Knesset Yisrael to compose its Haggadah, yet to leave out the name of its main hero, is not shared by the Marxist Mapai. In its Haggadah, the political party takes the floor with its leader at the head. The populace, the masses, they play a secondary role. This type of complex manifests in remarkable political constellations founded upon disputatiousness and ultimatums. Such a climate is unhealthy from a general political standpoint as well. But another abnormal phenomenon has developed out of the sense of my own power and the might of my own hand have won this wealth for me. The delusion, God help us, of omniscience, of knowing everything. We are all aware that we ascribe this attribute to the Almighty alone, and that men of flesh and blood, even the greatest among them, must be limited in their knowledge. But the haughty continue to delude themselves. To our great regret, many of the Mapai leaders, and Ben-Gurion especially, suffer from this malady. They know everything and place much weight on their own opinions. The former prime minister speaks about classical and modern physics and the theory of relativity, about Greek and Chinese philosophy, about the Bible in general, and the Song of Songs in particular. In short, about all the seven wisdoms. Why not? Why should we care if someone enjoys that? Can this not be classified as, quote, one person benefits and his fellow loses nothing? See Gemara Bava Kamma 20b. When I read Ben-Gurion's articles on manners about which neither he nor I know anything, I smile. I put down the newspaper and I think to myself, look what a Minerva he is. Neither Churchill nor Anthony Eden nor Truman nor Eisenhower speaks about physics or Greek philosophy. But the Mapai and its leader also think of themselves as experts in Judaism, not just in abstract Jewish thought, but in the halakha, in what is prohibited and what is permitted, what ritually impure and what pure, what responsible and what exempt. And here the danger begins, because with their influence and prestige, they can mislead the state to follow in their false, perilous ways, and even force it to do so. It is a conscious lie when people accuse the state of Israel of religious persecution. Heaven forbid. The Mapai is not anti-religious. Rather, it misleads and gets involved in Judaism-related matters, seeking to imprint its view of Judaism on the religious conscience of the public. Here, one may not remain passive. I am convinced that many times they mean well, but the fact that when he was strong, he grew arrogant, well, it ruins everything. I will give as my first example, specifically not the case of national service for women, but something else, which is, in my opinion, much more serious in importance. I refer to the case of German reparations. We Jews have a passage in the Torah about Amalek, quote, for there is a hand upon the throne of God, ki yad al kes ka, it's my bar mitzvah parsha, so I can't remember it, for there is a hand upon the throne of God. The Almighty will be at war with Amalek, ki yad al kes ka, milchama l'Hashem ba'amalek, midor dor, for there is a hand upon the throne of God. The Almighty will be at war with Amalek throughout the ages. See Exodus 17. By law, Amalek does not refer to a particular racial group, but rather to the ideology of, let us wipe them out as a nation. Israel's name will be mentioned no more. See Psalm 83. Various nations have, from time to time, fit this definition. And there is no doubt that the Nazis of 10 to 15 years ago were true Amalekites. And we Jews, who have an eternal memory, remember what Amalek did to you on your journey after you left Egypt. We Jews should not have taken any money from them. Such money is, it seems to me, soaked with the blood of the small children whom the Nazis made their name be blotted out, cast into the crematoria. A Jewish hand, even that of a prime minister who can claim great historical accomplishments, should have been scalded by such blood-soaked money. I would have preferred establishing diplomatic relations with them without taking any blood money from them. You can say what you want, The German government considers the reparations to be blood money for the 6 million Jews, and other Gentiles think the same thing. And on top of it, people praise Konrad Adenauer's generosity in committing to paying so much money in order to make peace with the Jews. You hear? Jews are taking blood money in compensation for the loss of a third of their people. Jews can reconcile with the Nazis so long as they pay well. Jews and money. You all know Karl Marx's wise words about that in his essay on the Jewish question. I don't read a thing by Marx, so I don't really know. I don't think anything Karl Marx ever said was wise. But if Soloveitchik thinks so, then we should consider it. Were the reparations simply a political question that Ben-Gurion was qualified to answer? Or were they a question of religious conscience, affecting innumerable generations yet unborn? If the Nazis could exterminate 6 million Jews, and we could then go on to drink a toast with the murderers, then we can never be safe. What right do we have to protest now against the Nazi, Felix von Eckhart, being sent by the German government to the United Nations? The Gentile world knows all about it. And do not tell me some old wives' tale that you take the money without forgiving the Nazis. Why did we not listen to the voice of the old prophet Samuel? Quote, why did you disobey God and swoop down on the spoils in defiance of the Almighty's will? Samuel's question of Saul. See 1 Samuel 15. Why did we forget the words of the scroll of Esther that give expression to the Jewish historical religious conscience? But they did not lay hands on the spoil. You think that only the state of Israel needs money? Samuel and Mordechai were also needy. But nothing can justify this sin, not even saving lives. Those who took this responsibility upon themselves, the Mapai, the General Zionists, and Ben-Gurion, imposed their decision on the masses. By murky means, they organized a conference of Jewish communal activists. In 1952, half-assimilated and half-alienated Jews, who in turn conferred their imprimatur, their stamp of approval. Half-assimilated, half-alienated Jews are going to be approving this. How could they bring themselves to do so? When he was strong, he grew arrogant, and they dared assume historical responsibility that I myself would not have wanted to bear before the judicial bench of eternal Israel. Where was the Mizrahi at that time? Why did the Mizrahi not raise its voice in protest and break the foolish hegemony of an individual and a party, a hegemony based on gaiva and madness? One person did fight against it, Mordechai Nurok. The rest kept silent and remained in the government. Surely we must all confess and strike our chests while reciting the Al-Chait litany. However, the Mizrahi does not deserve all the blame. Where was the good of Israel? Why did its leader leave the Knesset for the vote? Because he was afraid of Ben-Gurion's ultimatum? Why did the Torah giants not rule, let him give his life rather than sin? Why did the Union of Orthodox Rabbis not organize a rally in the Polo Gardens? Go and assemble, said Esther, and protest against a handful of Jews who wanted to violate the commandment to remember what Amalek did to you. Why did the representatives of the RCA, the Rabbinical Council of America, not fly to Israel? Why did the zealots from Williamsburg, the Hasidic Rebbes and their Shtreimlich, not storm the consulates? I did not hear even a single voice of protest from extremist orthodoxy at that time. On the contrary, it was actually the radicals, whether the Chirut Party in the Land of Israel or the Yiddishists, who took action. If you, too, had organized a revolt at that time, not, heaven forbid, against the Israeli government, but rather against an idolatrous cult of personality, against gaiva and hysterical chutzpah, the Knesset Yisrael would have joined you, and you would have won the struggle for all time. You would not have had to make noise and move heaven and earth over national service with everyone opposing you and with your demonstrations leading only to Chil Hashem. Instead, you were silent. Genesis 42. That is why this distress has come upon us, the brothers said to each other about the Joseph matter in front of Joseph. This is why this distress has come upon us, because we sold our brother to slavery. You were silent, and that's why this distress came upon us. I will lead in reciting the Al-Chait Litany, and together with me, you must all confess, from the Mizrahi to the Neturei Karta. Coast to coast, all the religious Jews are responsible for this. With the question of national service of women, the same tragic comic scene has repeated itself. The prime minister and the Mapai leadership And as usual, our own Torah scholars, who are positioned close to the authorities, are also to blame. They have deluded themselves into thinking that they can rule on halachic matters. I maintain again that Ben-Gurion does not wish to act against religion here, heaven forbid. He is convinced that he is conducting himself in accordance with the Shulchan Aruch, especially since an authentic quote, "Let the bridegroom come out of his chamber, let the bride from her canopy couch," it's the book of Joel, chapter 2, that supposedly proves the correctness of his view. See Gemara Sota, chapter 8, Mishnayos 6 and 7. And in turn, this opinion must become law, because such is his will, at know-it-all. And in turn, the same method of issuing an ultimatum is implemented. Vote for this bill, or else a different bill will not be passed, forcing the conscience of religious Jews to accept a statute that the Torah giants consider to be at variance with Jewish law. The Mizrahi should have fought against the method itself, just like every other democratically inclined individual. And I wish to tell you that certain democratic principles are also tenets of Judaism. But in this connection, the Aguda and all the Tzaddikim and Torah giants are just as guilty as we are. However, something else is also at play here. The question was raised by two journalists in the press, Rabbi Simcha Elberg in Hapardes and David Flinker in the Morgan Journal, regarding authority and halachic decision-making. As critical and democratic as we might be in the field of the halacha, we nevertheless cannot tolerate anarchy. At the end of the day, we obviously want to have an authority, especially when the opposition consists of people who have no knowledge of the halacha. The first question vis-a-vis national service, as these two journalists put it, is, who is the Jewish people's halachic authority? The answers to this question that I have read in the Mizrahi Veg are non sequiturs on the model of, quote, a person claimed the debt of wheat from his fellow who admitted owing him barley. See Shavuos chapter 6. But I wish they had something that those two journalists did not discuss. They formulated the question as it relates to Torah giants. I wish to ask about the chief rabbinate as well. I believe that the chief rabbinate, with Rabbi Isaac Herzog as its head, is also fit to rule in halachic matters. Rabbatai, I too know that my uncle, the Brisker Rav, Rabbi Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, is a Torah giant, a gaon among gaonim. His scholarly output is small in quantity but great in quality. See Yevamos 49b. I still have a bit of a connection to my father's house and recognize my uncle's worth. But among Jews, rabbis appointed by the community would rule on the halachic questions that came before them, even when great scholars lived in their towns. The Maharshal certainly knew how to learn Torah, but he was not the rabbi of Lublin. The Vilna Gaon was a layman in Vilna, whose rabbi was Rabbi Shmuel ben Avigdor, the last Abdezdin of the city. The author of the Prima Gadim, Rabbi Yosef Toman, was a yeshiva dean in Berlin during the period when the Abdezdin was Rabbi Hirsch Levin. Rabbi Nathan Adler, the most pious Kohen, lived in Frankfurt when the rabbi there was the author of the Haflah. Rabbi Meir Simcha, the author of the Or Sameach, was a resident of Bialystok. But the rabbinate was occupied by Rabbi Shmuel Mulliver. But the question remains, who is the halachic authority in the land of Israel? The chief rabbinate, headed by Rabbi Herzog, or the Mapai MKs led by Ben-Gurion? I just read the transcript of that Knesset session. The Mapai members did not assert that they wanted to pass a law contravening the Torah. Heaven forbid. They were convinced that what they were doing was sanctioned by the Torah. The biblical verse, that the bridegroom come out of his chamber, the bride from her canopied couch, was cited by almost everyone. In other words, the entire Knesset debate took on the form of a Talmudical dispute between the Mapai members and the Torah giants, including the chief rabbinate, which is, in principle, opposed to national service for women. It is true that the chief rabbinate decided that Mizrahi and Apollo Mizrahi members should not leave the coalition in order to protect other religious interests, for example, the marriage and divorce law. I do not criticize this directive, and I believe that American rabbis have no right to overrule Rabbi Herzog. But this directive should be understood in the sense of a Eitzlasus Lashem. It is a time to act for God. Heferu Torah Secha. They have violated your Torah. See Psalm 119. See Gemara Timura 14b. Rabbi Yossi Yehuda Unterman said the same thing in his latest interview with David Flinker in 1954. In the end, Ben-Gurion and his associates ruled on a halachic question against the true halachic authorities and judges of Israel, and they prevailed. This victory, in turn, was also expressed in a condescending attitude toward Torah giants in general and toward the chief rabbi in particular. We know well how insultingly many members of the government related to the chief rabbi. Letters went unanswered. The chief rabbi was attacked many times from the Knesset podium, and people played on the phonetic similarity of the words rabbanut, which means rabbinate, and ribonut, sovereignty. The sort of thing that happens neither in the American Congress nor in the English Parliament. Believing and unbelieving Gentiles alike know that religious figures must be respected. Here in America, too, the same contempt for Torah giants is manifest. I'll give you an example. The Union of Orthodox Rabbis sent a letter to Ambassador Abba Iban, asking him to receive a delegation of rabbis who wanted to discuss national conscription of women with him. He responded that he had no time. I believe him, that he does not have much time. However, I see that often he does have time, as when a couple of big shots in the United Jewish Appeal invite him, and he comes and spends an entire evening with them. Could he not spare half an hour to receive a delegation of older rabbis whose hair has grayed within the tent of Torah? The prophet Elisha was also a great man, a statesman. Still, he had time for the common folk as well. See 2 Kings 4, when a certain woman, the wife of one of the disciples of the prophets, came running to him in tears. He did not respond that he was busy. He had to go to the United Nations. And when the Shunammite woman fell at his feet and Gehazi, who's probably akin to a modern diplomat, rushed to push her away, the old prophet instructed, let her alone, for she is in bitter distress. I wish to point out that I am not an agent of the Union of Orthodox Rabbis. I do not agree with them on many points. The short-sightedness and partisanship of their leadership in not sending an official greeting to this conference dismayed me greatly. However, they represent the traditional rabbinate, among whose ranks can be found Torah giants, and an Israeli envoy should have showed them more respect. All of these developments rankled not only those looking for grievances against the land of Israel, but even our own lovers of Zion. I myself was upset. I'm not interested at the moment in the question of national service for women. The problem is more global and more serious. We are not talking about a solitary issue, but about a spiritual climate, an atmosphere, a method, an approach. We're talking about the apotheosis and glorification of an individual or a party, about stubborn, disputatious governance, about ultimatums and party discipline that seep into areas where the conscience alone should decide, or where only qualified persons can come to a determination. We are talking about a gaiva that has resulted in many mistakes and follies, fractured the Zionist Organization of America, and left Israel without an organized political defense structure, which did wonders for the establishment of the state. We are talking about disputatiousness that imposed on the Knesset Yisrael a pact with the Nazis. We are talking about many diplomatic blunders in the international arena that have, to a certain degree, isolated Israel. We are talking about a worldview and a lifestyle that are fundamentally un-Jewish. The apotheosis of man, idolatry. It is this false philosophy that brought about the whole commotion in connection with national service for women. Only the evil inclinations for gaiva and disputatiousness could have made such a fuss about a few hundred girls and thereby entangled the Mizrahi and a Apoel Mizrahi in a religious struggle that damages the state as a whole and its best builders in particular. I ask the government, was it worth it? Is that the old Agadah about Alexander the Macedonian seeking to attack the Amazons, the kingdom of women, Sigmar Atamid 32a, repeating itself? What will you have achieved if you force these 300 girls to desecrate Shabbos? Surrender the point. Show some self-discipline. With your stubbornness, you make the task of your best friends extremely complicated. I have not personally gotten involved in the whole dispute, but as an ally of the State of Israel, I beg you, quote, please, my friends, do not commit such a wrong. see Genesis 19. The idea of tshuva in Judaism manifests not only in hakarat achet and breaking one's will in a sense of human lowliness, but also in an awareness of human loftiness and belief in one's immense creative faculties. It is not for naught that during Ne'ilah on Yom Kippur we say, all the mighty are as nothing before you, God, and the men of renown might as well not exist, for their many deeds are in vain. The days of their lives are like hot air before you, and man has no superiority over beast, since both amount to nothing. Ecclesiastes 3. And then in the same breath, we quickly begin reciting, you distinguished man from the outset and recognized him to stand before you. Man is small, but also great. If he loses his sense of you distinguished, his faith in himself, first, he must descend into sin. And second, he can never raise himself up from the depths like a lion. We have to differentiate sharply between gaiva and geut, which is grander. Gaiva is a vain pride that expresses itself in self-glorification and self-deification. Gaiva is idolatrous. Geut, however, is an attribute of the Almighty God. The Almighty is King. He is robed in geut. See Psalm 93. And as such, is certainly a good one, that attribute. It connotes faith in the spiritual persona of man, in his tselem Elokim, in his divine image, and it poses no contradiction to humility and modesty. After my hakarat achet, after confessing that all the mighty are as nothing before you, God, I must end with, you distinguished mankind. See Gemara Brachas, for so we find among the early prophets, they concluded their speeches with words of praise and consolation. Brachas 31a. At this point, the raven yields the floor to the dove. The raven has had a chance to read aloud, but now the dove will speak. That same faultless dove, the enthusiast, which, toward evening, in a moment of bleak despair, came to Noah in the ark, bringing a tithing of redemption, light, and majesty. And there in its bill was a plucked-off olive leaf. Now we come to Maftir, to divine vision, prophecy. And here, my friends, we reached the halfway point. It's a long speech, and there's no way for me to finish it right now. Another 10 pages. So I'm going to let it go. We'll finish up, God willing, next week. Let me think. Yeah, Monday. Yentif ends Sunday evening. So we're back on for Monday next week, God willing. So we'll pick it up then on page 171, and we'll hear Rabbi Soloveitchik as he adopts the dove and see what he says and how he's going to speak words of praise and consolation, divine vision and prophecy. I thank you so much for listening. A big, big thank you to all of you who make the class so special. Excuse me, I wish you a good moed. Imoadim l'simcha. Chagim uzmanim l'sason, as I say in Israel. Wishing you only the best. God willing, tomorrow night, I'm not sure where I'm going to be. Maybe on the road, maybe in the shul. But with God's help, we will do our Tanakh Tuesday class, 2 Kings, chapter 21. Thank you so much for coming out. Wishing everybody only the best. Let's call it Moed Tzikus. Beautiful weather. Enjoy it all, people. Thank you, Zen Kultuf, and we'll see you tomorrow night for Tanakh Tuesday. Take care and be well.